How hard will Florida make voting this year? How healthy is Miami Beach making spring break next month? How diverse has South Beach made its wine and food fest this week? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine legislative efforts to rein in systems like Palm Beach County's that make early voting easier. Is it part of a larger campaign to make voting harder in upcoming elections? We'll also check out Miami Beach's spring break reform campaign to replace beer chugging with beach jogging and toga parties with yoga parties. And we'll look at the 25th anniversary of the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, more Afro-Caribbean chefs and students. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. 2 years ago, in the 2024 Florida primary election, President Trump voted early in Palm Beach County using a ballot marking system called Express Vote that makes early voting easier and faster. He had no complaints about it then. He even praised poll workers there for doing a fantastic job. But fast forward 2 years, and Republicans in the Florida legislature are now pushing bills that would rein in, if not ban, express vote in Palm Beach and two other counties. Their reasons aren't quite clear, and that has only raised fears among voting rights advocates that the intent isn't to make voting in Florida more secure, but rather more difficult. The express vote provision, for example, is part of a larger measure that would require more stringent proof of citizenship and ID when registering to vote and to vote. Florida's Republicans insist they're eliminating vote fraud. Their critics insist they're just out to reduce voting in the run-up to midterm elections that polls show the GOP losing. As always, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the matter. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Mitch Perry, who's been covering these issues as senior reporter for the Florida Phoenix. Mitch, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Good morning, Tim.
And with me here in the studio is WLRN investigative reporter Daniel Rivero, who recently published a book titled Just Freedom, Inside Florida's Decades-Long Voting Rights Battle. Danny, how are you?
I'm doing great, Tim. Good to be here.
Danny, let's start with a dispute over the use of the so-called express vote system that Palm Beach County, as well as Lee and Duval counties, have been using in recent election cycles for voting. What's the difference between using express vote if you go to vote early in an election and the standard conventional means of voting?
I mean, just to break it down, if you go vote on voting day, on election day, geographically, they know where you live.
Right, you're in the precinct
because
you're supposed to be. Right, yeah.
So they pre-print ballots based on where you live in that in that general area. When you go early voting, there's usually a few sites around the county, and anyone that lives anywhere can go there.
Yeah.
And so when you show up to go to do early voting, you present your information, and they print out a ballot for exactly where you live, your school board race, your city commission race, your congressional race, et cetera.
And that can take some time.
It takes about 45 seconds on average to print that out. What this system Express Vote does is it prints out a very short piece of paper with a barcode on it in about 3 seconds, and you put that into a computer system and you vote through the computer system, and you still vote, but it's just, it eliminates the 45 second wait to vote. But where it really makes a difference, as we've heard from these three counties, is when lines form for early voting. And when you multiply it, you know, across the board, it's a difference between swift and fast line or hours long line.
I think Palm Beach County was saying something like they were saving 17 hours, you know, per a day in total.
Exactly.
On this sort of thing. And again, as we noticed, as I mentioned earlier, even President Trump seemed to give it a thumbs up in 2024. So we haven't really heard much GOP complaint about this particular system then, have we, up till now?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, President Trump praised this specific system, but there have been mostly coming from Republicans, just general skepticism of
about express vote.
About express vote or other kinds of tech being used. There's the general movement is paper ballots only.
And that's the crux, really, then, of the Republicans' objections to this, right?
Exactly.
When we look at State Senator Aaron Grawl, for example, the sponsor of the bill in Tallahassee, that's what they're saying, is that they just feel that paper is more secure than this kind of electronic option.
Exactly. I mean, the way they see it in general terms, because it's hard to pin a lot of people down on this, is that there's less room for manipulation of any kind, bad actors of any kind, if there's physical paper trail.
Right. But in the meantime, if this measure passes, Palm Beach County, for example, would be on the hook for 500 machines at about $4,000 each.
Yeah, they've spent millions on this already.
Yeah. So, Mitch Perry, could you tell us, actually, the measure that Danny and I were just talking about is actually part of a larger, broader bill. In the Senate, it's SB 1334. In the House companion bill, it's HB 991. Excuse me. Can you fill us in a little bit then on what those two bills are getting at in terms of demanding proof of citizenship for voter registration,
right,
and more stringent ID for actual voting?
Yeah, exactly. These bills have a lot of provisions in it, but the big one is that it requires new proof of citizenship requirements for voting. And in that respect, it mirrors the Save America Act, which is passed in the Congress already, or the House of Representatives. Of course, the Republicans, they can't get the 60 votes to pass it in the Senate. There's talk about breaking the filibuster because they're so intent on getting this passed. So essentially, it says, you know, right now in Florida, it's illegal to vote if you're a non-citizen, right? And
sure.
But I guess the advocates would say for this bill is that, you know, just checking off a box isn't enough. You know, and basically right now, unless the records that the Supervisor of Elections office receives otherwise, that voter can vote. But this new law says you must show proof of citizenship. Mm-hmm. So if you're already registered, but you want to change your address, your party, or your name, you'd have to produce a driver's license, ID, or the last four digits of a Social Security number with your local Supervisor of Elections. Now, the advocates say, bill supporters say, this will not affect most voters because if you have a real ID compliant driver's license, you're okay because that already shows that you are a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And the last records we see from a year ago show that 99% of people in Florida, I don't know if that's voters, but just the people of driver's licenses, period, are real ID compliant. But so what we don't know is how many people who aren't, who would be in that gap where they would need to have, you know, whether it's a birth certificate or a copy of their, a copy of birth certificate, a passport, a valid passport, or some other pieces of identification to prove that. And the critics of this bill say that that's not so easy for some people, and that you're going to do is end up kicking off U.S. U.S. citizens from the poll.
And later in the segment, Mitch, I want to talk with you about a very important point you made in your reporting this week about the state of Kansas. But we'll get to that in a second. Danny, just hopping off of what you know, the really good points Mitch was making there. I think a lot of people would sort of stand back and ask, well, what is the proof of citizenship, you know, criteria we do use now? What is the procedure? If I go out into a neighborhood and you know, to register people to vote, if it is under the state constitution of Florida mandatory that you be a U.S. citizen to vote, I would imagine then you have to show some proof of citizenship to register to vote, no?
You know, the reality is that I don't know the percent off the top of my head, but a great amount of registering people to vote goes through the driver's license offices. And when you go to a DMV office, you have to present a lot of information. So at some point, probably the majority of people that have driver's licenses, if they're citizens, have had to present their birth certificates, passports, something of
a social security number.
Something of that along the way. And then once you present that, when you register or renew your driver's license, you can at the office itself re-register to vote or register to vote.
Right.
So a lot of it happens that way. But you know, there are portals where you can register to vote online, and it's up to each supervisor of elections office to do some due diligence to find out that you are in fact a citizen.
But then the next question would be, is this proof of citizenship issue really a concern that we should, you know, in Florida? I mean, are we seeing so many people registering, non-citizens registering in Florida, that we really have to be that worried about it.
No, I mean, it's one of the things that we've talked about it for years, but there by any measure has not been a major problem on this. I mean, there surely in Florida and other places have been isolated cases slipping through the cracks.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone denies that, but it is not a widespread issue.
Right. And Mitch Perry, you watch this in Tallahassee a lot.
Yeah.
Can you sort of summarize for us what are the for and against when it comes to more stringent voting ID? You know, you were talking about real ID compliance and things of that nature. One of the State Senator Graul, for example, she said this week that there are too many loopholes in the registration procedure, for example, and whereas others, voting right advocate, like State Senator Tina Polsky from Palm Beach County, we're saying, no, we don't have all those loopholes. And if you're making voter ID so stringent, it's going to, reduce, the number of people voting. What are the for and against here that you see are most prominent?
Yeah, well, I would say for it is, again, people believe that it's not stringent enough right now in terms of what allowing non-citizens to vote. But as you were just talking about, that's really not true. I do believe, I think I have a stat here, the Florida's Office of Election Crimes and Security, which of course was enacted from a legislation a few years ago to look at this in terms of people who were illegally voting. It reported last year that 198 citizens were registered to vote, non-citizens, excuse me, were registered to vote. And that's out of a statewide voter roll of 13.3 million.
Yeah.
So that is like way less than 0.01%.
Right. Yeah.
So it really doesn't exist. I mean, it just doesn't. And you'll hear critics nationally, you hear maybe more than Florida, about know that this has happened, and they'll find examples of it. And it's a driving force of conservatives right now. And that's what you're seeing again in Washington right now, that this is really needed. And I will tell you that these, voting integrity people who really emerged after the 2020 election where Donald Trump lost nationally, won here in Florida. But in Florida, these are pretty interesting groups. They don't go and speak a lot in Tallahassee at these committee meetings, but they meet, they lobby the legislators, and they're kind of on the political right of a lot of these legislators. So I think in part, that's why you're seeing that these Republicans feel that they need to put these bills out there year after year, when we are always told that we've actually had pretty smooth elections, which I think we really have.
But Mitch, just quickly, the Democrat and the voter rights advocate side, though, they're saying that if you keep pressing for real ID, things like that, you're still going to have a lot of people out there who don't have that kind of ID, and that the these kinds of measures are simply going to see voter numbers fall as a result. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, and they cite you mentioned the Kansas, that. So this was a bill that was passed.
I want to get to that in just a second, Mitch.
Okay, sure.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Mitch Perry of the Florida Phoenix and WLRN's Daniel Rivero about the debate over whether Florida this year is making voting more secure or more difficult, especially in South Florida venues like Palm Beach County. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Danny, you made the point that this is happening in an election year. Why is that unusual to see this kind of flurry of activity on voter security legislation in an election year?
Right. So, I've been covering voting rights and voting legislation for years now. As we mentioned, I just wrote a book to plug myself.
Yes, no.
And through that process, it has been explained to me by senior Republican legislative officials that if the general practice is, if you're going to implement major voting changes, you do that on an off year. It's why, in 2021, there were major changes. It's why in 2019, there were major changes. You don't do it on a year where there's major elections taking place. Because if this goes into law, there's going to be elections about a month later. Yep. And the effect would be immediate. And it takes, we know through practice and just history, it takes months and months, if not years, to figure out the details on how these things work in practice. You can put it on the page, but then it gets really messy if you're implementing it immediately with high stakes elections. And
So this is why Democrats are saying this is just a veiled effort to make voting harder, because Republicans supposedly benefit from voting restrictions, and especially in a year like this when they're staring at perhaps big losses in the midterm elections, because minorities and recent citizens, for example, they're the inconvenient voter for the Republican Party, as the argument goes.
Right. And just, you know, there is the stat that 99% of drivers have real ID, which is true. There's no reason to think that's untrue. There's over 13 million registered voters. If there's 1% of voters affected by this because they don't have the right ID, you're talking about 13,000 voters. There's been elections in recent history, statewide elections, settled by less than that amount.
Right. Mitch Perry, the top story in the Washington Post this morning, for example, was the headline was "The Department of Justice Struggles as White House Presses on Voter Fraud." Is there a sense here in Florida as well that they're just straining to find a voter fraud crisis? And I want to get then to the point you were making about Kansas, that as they're straining, we could be seeing mistakes made that drop, as you were saying, in Kansas, more than 31,000 U.S. citizens were mistakenly knocked off the voter rolls there about 15 years ago.
Yeah, Tim, you know, you really, in even these committee hearings this session, you haven't heard a lot of legitimate, I mean, issues where non-citizens voted. They don't, it's just more the concern of that, right? We always hear that Florida wants to lead the way on elections. Yes, we've been really had secure elections, but we can't stand pat. So we need to be aggressive in moving forward with this. But no, there haven't been a lot of examples on that. I also want to say something that you guys were talking about election year. One of the discrepancies between the two bills is the Senate bill would kick in, if it's in fact signed into law, in July of this year, which is very concerning with the
month
August
before primaries. Yes.
Right. The House bill says not till January of 2027. So, you know, when they ultimately get both of these bills passed, they're going to have to, you know, reconcile that. So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, going back to, you mentioned Kansas. So there was a similar proposal that actually basically became a law in 2011. And that did result in over 31,000 citizens, U.S. citizens, having their voter registrations blocked. This law ultimately was found to be unconstitutional by a federal judge in 2018. And it was affirmed by a federal appeals court in 2020. Other states are coming back with this, though, not just Florida, in terms of, again, thinking that we need this for election security.
Mm-hmm. Danny, your book, Just Freedom, Inside Florida's Decades-Long Voting Rights Battle, it was more focused on the struggle to restore voting rights to ex-convicts. But does this moment now raise the same concerns about Florida's efforts to chip away at voter volume of groups that, as I said before, may seem inconvenient to the party in power?
There is a little bit of overlap in terms of what precipitated a lot of the activism that led to the, you know, a lot of people getting their voting rights back that had felony convictions, was laws that were passed and the bureaucratic inability to keep up with it. And so, like, in the 2000 election, we don't know how many people were prevented from voting in that very crucial election because of bureaucratic issues, because of a new law that was passed. And the state was unable to get their stuff in order. And U.S. citizens, people who should have been able to vote, were not able to vote because of bureaucratic issues.
Right.
And there's all the alarm bells are ringing off right now. For example, what happened in Kansas, of we could be willingly going into that territory.
Right. And the Democrats would say it's no coincidence that one of the targets, for example, are counties like Palm Beach, where you do see an appreciable number of Democratic voters. Mitch Perry, finally, in just 30 seconds, where do things stand with SB 1334 and HB 991 and any other maybe similar bills in the offing in this session? But where do things stand with this legislation?
Sure. Right now, SB 1334, the Senate bill, it has one more stop in the Rules Committee. That has not been a date assigned to it yet. Once it gets through there, both bills will then head to the floors of the respective chambers. That's when we will see some, you know, again, the reconciliation, because there are differences between the two bills.
Right, as you pointed out earlier. Mitch Perry is senior reporter at the Florida Phoenix. Daniel Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Miami Beach wants spring breakers to trade beer chugging for barbell pumping. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Most of us are familiar with the so-called divorce Miami Beach has had with spring break in recent years. Fed up with the Bacchanalian rowdiness, which tragically included two shooting deaths 3 years ago, the city has taken stringent measures to reduce and control the crowds of students and other spring break revelers who descend on South Beach every March, which arrives in just a week, by the way. And despite complaints from local businesses like bars, Miami Beach officials have claimed success. But now Miami Beach is trying something altogether different. Rather than just contain the spring break culture, it wants to reform it. Along with the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, it has launched a marketing campaign, complete with a minute and a half long video, that promotes what it calls a healthier spring break. It wants breakers to throw back fewer vodka shots and more veggie smoothies, to trade toga parties for yoga parties. But will the fraternity brothers and sorority sisters buy it? What do you think? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is Alex Fernandez. He's one of the Miami Beach City Commissioners who championed this healthier spring break campaign. Commissioner Fernandez, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so let's look at this campaign. It's called, well, the video anyway, it's called Wake Up to a New March. And it shows, I really enjoyed it. It shows a guy back in 2016, a spring breaker 2016. He's in a coma for a decade. He wakes up this year, 2026, goes out on Ocean Drive and finds a completely new, different kind of spring break where students are jogging, pumping iron, drinking veggie smoothies, playing
green
volleyball,
juice,
and
volleyball.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's let's play a little clip from it so people can get an idea of the tone of it.
Excuse me, sir. There's no drinking in public. Green juice?
Well, we can't see the look on his face when he's offered green juice, but but how did Miami Beach and Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau come up with this and why?
Listen, we've matured. There was a lot of drama to get past, and now we've found a new, more mature, more health and wellness focused vision for the month of March. Mm-hmm. And it's defined by the Lifetime 305 Half Marathon. It's defined by Wadapalooza. It's defined with partnerships with Adidas. We're going to have all of this good activity, healthy activity,
fitness
yeah. activity. It's the best weather. It's the most beautiful time of the year. Yeah. And there are people that want to fill our hotel rooms, who want to spend money, who want to enjoy our city. And what a better time to do it than in March. And so it's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. We got over the violence. We got over the drama. And now we're reopening our city to something that's healthy and fun.
But how, though, will this program work beyond just a very clever promotional ad? How do you get this new spring culture to actually play out on South Beach in the month of March?
Well, it's through programming, positive programming. You see, what we saw is that we shut down the city. But success cannot be measured through shutdowns. Yes, we proactively endorsed curfews. We closed down garages. We were closing our beaches at 6 o'clock and shutting down sidewalk cafes. And you would drive down Washington and Ocean Drive and it was filled with barricades. It looked like a war scene. Mm-hmm. And what we realized, that is not the measure of success. An active city is a successful city.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Yeah. And so we realized we need to bring in these positive activities so that people can come into the city. They're not encountered with a war zone.
So Miami Beach is going to have programs out on the beach, to bring students into weightlifting there on the beach, as the ad shows, to have them buy, veggie smoothies out on Ocean Drive and, instead of throwing back Jell-O shots, et cetera. You're going to have active programming out on
Every week we have activities that we are producing. I mean, we're talking about Adidas is coming in. We're bringing in High Rocks that's going to be in our convention center. By the way, that's bringing in thousands of athletes into Miami Beach. We have Wadapalooza, which is the world's largest fitness festival and competition. That is also in bringing in thousands of people from around the world into our beaches. We've got the Lifetime Marathon. These are actual real real high-profile activities that are going to be bringing in people who are going to be spending money in our restaurants, staying in our hotels, and supporting our economy, which is a difference from before. We were shutting down the city before.
Right. Well, let's revisit that nationally famous, because it did get a lot of national media attention, as I recall, that famous divorce Miami Beach had with spring break in recent years, stepped up law enforcement presence, the barriers you mentioned, parking restrictions. But Miami Beach, you know, in terms of containing, as I said before, spring break, has claimed victory. Why?
Well, I'll tell you, for the first time in over a decade, last spring break, we had no stampedes, no shootings. We didn't have to impose a curfew. We didn't have a state of emergency. Now, where were we before that? We had a troubling trend of 33 shootings as of since 2012. To 2024, we had 33 shootings, 16 stampedes. People were scared to show up to work. Businesses were being destroyed, and the reputation of the city was getting damaged throughout the world. And so we were able to implement the strictest measures ever imposed. And by the end of last spring break, we saw a decrease in the total number of arrests. We saw a reduction in felonies. We saw a reduction in calls for police service in double digits.
Now, however, while they appreciate the restored sense of spring break order, some Miami Beach business owners still think the medicine was perhaps too strong. AJ Prasaget is a general manager for the Palace restaurant in Miami Beach.
I think the last 2 years, you know, there was a strong level of safety needed. There were some restrictions that were a little too tight, but it's also was very tough for us because it was our busiest month of the year, historically, always. And that put a damper on it with spring break looking like a war zone, so to speak. But we're glad that is more so in the past with these lighter restrictions for this year.
Ezequiel Timberini, he's the manager of the Beach Food and Drinks on Ocean Drive, had this to say.
They did a great job in the city and the police department. They did a great job. It was no incidents at all. But also they killed the business. So I believe that the balance will be the best this year. I believe that people will come more. The restaurant will look better. Pretty sure that the police is going to be all around and improve on the security for the citizens and the people that we live here and the work we work here and also the tourists. And it should be a better year, better than last year and better than 5 years ago when it was maybe a little bit too much.
Commissioner Fernandez, what's your response to their assessments there of the situation?
The business community realized that it was too much, and the business community realized that these measures were necessary and that balance is also necessary. So we've worked with them. In fact, many of the measures that we implemented were the ideas of businesses whose reputations were being damaged because the businesses were being destroyed and their employees didn't want to show up to work. So we have to collaborate with them. A lot of the ideas to fix spring break came from the businesses, but now we need to go back and support the businesses. And I want to make it also clear, yes, we're finding a middle ground here, but we're not repealing our endorsement of a curfew. Like, if we need to endorse a curfew, we will. Okay. And while parking garages will be open, the policy is still there that if it's needed, the city manager and the chief of police can at any time shut down our garages, our beaches, and sidewalk cafes. We haven't completely repealed all of these policies. They're still in the toolbox should it be necessary.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami Beach Commissioner Alex Fernandez about the city's new campaign to promote a healthier spring break, one that emphasizes beach jogging over beer chugging, and whether or not it will work. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So let's return to the healthier spring break campaign. Commissioner, how do you get college students, the frat bros and the sorority sisters, to buy into this? I mean, getting them to trade vodka for volleyball. I mean, they can do intramural sports and weightlifting and running back on campus. South Beach is why they're leaving campus for a week. How realistic is this?
Well, they want to be here. I mean, they're coming all the other months of the year, and the policies that we've had to institute in past spring breaks were deterring them from coming here. But the most important thing is not that the city of Miami Beach is telling them to come here. So now they have attractions. Now there are professionally produced events by high caliber event producers like High Rocks. High Rocks is a premier event that has been in the city before. People from around the world come here for High Rocks. They're the ones that are bringing them in. Wadapalooza is just another example that's going to be bringing in 40,000.
So you're sort of saying if you build it, the frat bros and sorority sisters will come.
Yeah. And we're not the ones having to build it. These big national renowned brands, they're the ones that are coming to Miami Beach and saying, this is the destination we want to be at. Okay. And this is where our consumer wants to come. And that's why we are able to say, okay, while we have the policy of proactively endorsing curfews, we don't anticipate having to put this curfew in place. And while we could shut down garages if necessary, we don't think we'll have to shut down garages, because the market that's coming is a market that wants to be respectful, enjoy the city, be healthy, and have a great time.
Have other spring break destinations around the country, have others tried this kind of thing? Is there a model, for example, that you were sort of looking at when you were devising this campaign? Have other places tried this? You know, again, if they build it, they will come. To direct them to this kind of thing.
I think Miami Beach is usually at the cutting edge. Mm-hmm. We're usually ahead of the trend. And I think when we look at what data tells us, even about alcohol consumption, younger people are not consuming as much alcohol.
That's a good point.
And even nightlife activity, they're focusing more on the sunrise activities and yoga and Pilates and running on the beach and going to Muscle Beach and pumping some iron. That's what the younger generation is interested in. It's less focus on nightlife, more focus on sunrise and health and wellness. That's what the brands are telling us, the brands that are coming and activating our city, because it's not the city that's activating it. It's not bureaucrats at City Hall. These are national brands that understand the market, and they're the ones that are guiding this transformation through their private activations.
A devil's advocate question, though. What if this emphasis on fitness over frat party backfires, in the sense that it drives spring breakers who still want that kind of spring break experience, the traditional experience, if it drives them away from Miami Beach even more than the recent security crackdowns did? What if it drives more of them up to Fort Lauderdale? What's the reaction going to be on Miami Beach, particularly in the business community then?
Listen, all of the strictest measures that we imposed, many of those draconian measures, they haven't been repealed. If we see that some of this activity comes back to Miami Beach, that we start seeing stampedes, that we start seeing lawlessness and shootings and stabbings, we can still impose a curfew. We can still shut down garages. We can still shut down the beach. We haven't repealed any of these strict policies, and they remain in the toolbox.
But you don't worry that this fitness campaign could perhaps alienate some of the more traditional-minded spring breakers who do want, you know, the party, you know, over volleyball.
Well, they've got their own destination that they could
go to.
We are the destination for health and wellness. If you want to go break the law and destroy a city, Miami Beach is not your place.
I know many Miami Beach leaders have said in recent years they want the city's identity to move beyond the party time image of events like spring break. What more grown-up identity does Miami Beach want that this healthy spring break campaign seems to reflect as we're looking, you know, moving ahead for the city?
Well, I think it goes beyond spring break, and it goes beyond our more pro-business approach that we're bringing into our city. For the past 30 years, we've passed a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of legislation that has hurt small businesses in our city and their ability to offer consumers with the type of product that they like. Mm-hmm. And so now we're facing competition from other areas like Coconut Grove, the Design District, Wynwood. Mm-hmm. And so we're going back and we're looking at our business policies, even with live entertainment. If a venue that was so beloved, like the Van Dyke's Cafe, were to come back and want to offer that sophisticated dinner and jazz experience, or a place like Tap Tap that used to exist, that used to have live Haitian culture
with
dinner. the policies weren't allowing those businesses to come back as of right. And so we're saying, okay, how can we bring back a responsible, law-abiding crowd into our city, giving them great daytime activations that focus around health and wellness, but still also giving them nighttime activities that are elevated, that everyone can enjoy, but you don't have to spend thousands of dollars in a supper club. So we're looking at our policies to make it easier to bring life and jazz and culture back into our nightlife, and redoing our policies, making it easier for restaurants, quality restaurants, to open up without having to jump over red tape for years just to open up a simple restaurant.
Well, healthy spring break, though. It's a fascinating campaign. Alex Fernandez is the Miami Beach City Commissioner for Group 3. Commissioner, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, the silver anniversary of the South Beach Wine and Food Festival and all its cool additions. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Back in 2001, a beverage marketing director named Lee Schrager thought of a way to make Ocean Drive more than just a parade ground for thong bikinis and Speedos. He launched the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. It's since become an annual three-day culinary happening on the sand, like an Art Basel for foodies that draws top chefs and sommeliers from around the world as well as South Florida. Yesterday, the South Beach Wine and Food Festival opened its 25th anniversary edition. And to mark that milestone, it's featuring a broader and more diverse array of offerings like master Afro-Caribbean chefs and more than 1,500 students from Florida International University's School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. And there's fare now not just for the palate, but the ear, too. At last night's opening party, Grammy Award-winning DJ Diplo performed. Are you a South Beach Wine and Food Festival fan or foe? Either way, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. With me now to fill us in on the festival's silver anniversary menu, our WLRN Morning Edition host, Natu Twe, and senior producer, Sherilyn Cabrera. How are you guys?
Great. Doing great.
Great to have you here. So, Natu, you spoke this week with festival founder Lee Schrager. Did he ever expect this thing to see its 25th anniversary and to become this big?
No. He actually said, if you asked me to bet 25 years ago, would I even see it to its 25th anniversary? He's like, I would have bet against the festival.
Why?
When they concocted the plan, had hatched this idea to move what was originally called the Florida Extravaganza, right on FIU's.
At FIU's campus.
Right,
yeah.
Biscayne Bay campus. He said, I just wanted to move it to South Beach, make it bigger, make it sexier, and make, you know, expand it and show more what the region and what other chefs have to offer. Mm-hmm. And he, almost like a gung-ho, just go all in. Just plan it for at the moment. There was no five-year plan. There was no one-year plan. He just took it over and said, we want to really showcase and what the students have to offer and what the region has to offer.
But how dramatically has it evolved since 2001? I mean, I mentioned it earlier. It seems today like the foodie equivalent of Art Basel, but how big an international event has this become?
Oh, man. I mean, I think the best way to describe it, Lee Schrager said, that first year, they didn't have tents. They didn't prepare for even rain or weather. They expected 1,000 people to come. They had 6,000. And that number has doubled, tripled almost at this point. And he said, the first year, we weren't flying in 400 chefs from around the world to come down to South Beach for this festival. I guess to give you an example of just how much talent.
And when something becomes that big, it's not just about the food and the wine, it's also about other things like music, right?
Yeah, of course. You know, as you mentioned, Diplo there at the opening day on the 19th yesterday, and they have rapper Fat Joe, Ja Rule, and hip-hop pioneer Reverend Run from Run DMC performing, I believe, tomorrow. DJ Cassidy closing out the event. Lee Schrager said, you know, they've had music events in the past. Willie Nelson performed once.
Oh, okay.
They had
right.
the
That's
20th
right.
anniversary, they had the Chainsmokers perform. But he wanted more than just, you know, an event, a musician here. He said, I've always wanted to have music being
it's kind more of an integral part.
Of the festival. And,
right.
Well, he got it.
Well, and Sherry, speaking of integral parts of the festival, FIU students, as I mentioned, have played a large role not just in the festival, but in the festival's growth. Tell us about that role that FIU students play.
Yeah, so as not to mention, FIU is where the festival began, even before 2001, 25 years ago. It used to be called the Florida Extravaganza in 1997. That's when it started. And it was a one-day student-run event. Lee obviously took over and expanded that. But students have remained a pretty big, vital part of the festival. In the last 25 years, the university says that at least 30,000 students have played some kind of role in helping this massive event function. So not only are students prepping the food, you've got students who are at the registration table, students who help with directions, students who help with logistics.
About 1,500 doing it this year, I think you reported this
week? Yep, 1,500 students.
Okay, yep. And as volunteers, right?
As volunteers, exactly. So they don't necessarily get paid because it's considered, you know, an educational
right because
part
they are getting things like credits
right exactly
because they are, as we said, from the School of Hospitality and Tourism, and this is great training for them. Let's hear from 21-year-old Fabiola Quereguan. She is a senior at FIU who plans to get an advanced degree in mega events. This is the school's largest master's degree program, actually. Let's hear what she has to say.
I participated when I was a junior and senior in high school, and then once I came to FIU as an actual student, I began my role as a coordinator for the festival. Without them, this festival really wouldn't be the huge success it is today, and no matter how basic the position, how short the shift, they're all super necessary in order for this to be as successful as it is.
Now, one of the things you reported this week was how much more diverse the festival is now. Let's actually hear Lee Schrager's take on that aspect of things.
Much more today than 25 years ago, much more today than 5 years ago. I look to be inclusive, something that we were not inclusive, not intentionally. It was just brought to my attention. Hey, how many women do you have participating? I'm like, I don't know. Or how many black or brown people? I'm like, I don't know. And, you know, once we knew it, you know, we paid a lot more attention to it.
Now, this greater diversity he's talking about, it's not just an international thing, but also a local thing. I mean, neighborhoods like Overtown, as you reported, played a big part in that, especially in the recent inclusion of more Afro-Caribbean chefs, right?
Right. You know, that's an interesting aspect. Black chefs, Afro-Caribbean chefs. It's to us here in South Florida, in Miami, in Miami-Dade, in Broward, that's an everyday aspect of our lives. You know, the Hispanic-Caribbean connection, the foods we eat, the music we listen to. And the past few years, recent years, there's a big explosion of not just Afro-Caribbean food, but also the music. You know, Tems, Burna Boy blowing up here in the West, across overseas, also on the other side of the continent. And plenty chefs across the country are embracing that cuisine. I spoke to Chef Tristan Epps. He won Top Chef 2025. He's from a Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaican background. Military mother, traveled all around the world, and he was the executive chef at Red Rooster in Overtown and Eden Rock in South Beach. And when he came here from Denver, he was in Denver, he worked.
But as you mentioned, he was also trained,
trained.
In Overtown at that restaurant
by Chef Marcus Samuelson.
Who's a big part of the festival, right?
Absolutely, yeah. A big part. Also helped Lee Schrager with adding in these more diverse chefs, these black chefs, these Afro-Caribbean chefs. Uh-huh. And they have a new event. The fact that they have a new event that's considered a signature of the festival, the Last Lap Link Up, celebrating Afro-Caribbean cuisine, kind of also shows that attention and focus on the cuisine and the culture after the heavy criticism the festival experienced and received about 4 years ago this time.
Okay, so he pivoted pretty quickly then on that. That's impressive. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Natu Twe and Sherilyn Cabrera about the 25th anniversary edition of what's become the world-renowned South Beach Wine and Food Festival. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Sherilyn Cabrera, when we talk about the FIU students, I think one of the things that I find interesting to ask is, what about their own futures? Like Daniel Marceline, a student at the school, the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism, who works a lot with the festival. Do any of them aspire to be a South Beach Wine and Food Festival top chef someday?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Daniel, who you just mentioned, is one of the students that I spoke with. He he will be preparing food at the festival this year. And he told me that he grew up around kitchens because his parents owned several restaurants in Haiti. So that's where he was born. And then he was raised in North Miami. But he told me food isn't his blood. So his passion for food runs deep. He told me that he actually wants to teach. So he wants to return as a chef professor at FIU. And also he wants to work behind the scenes in creating like personal branding for chefs. But then I also spoke to alumni of FIU's hospitality school. I spoke to Amanda Fraga. So she graduated in 2011 and worked at the festival for several years as a student. She's now the director of beverage for the Genuine Hospitality Group, which is owned by James Beard award-winning chef Michael Schwartz. And she has returned to the festival as a professional a couple of times and now might win her own James Beard as a semifinalist. She's a semifinalist for the work she has done for
semifinalist
Genuine, for beverage programming. And it's for the work that she's done for the Genuine Hospitality. And she told me that she credits a lot of what, you know, she knows now to not only working the festival, but because of her experience at FIU.
Oh, that's great. Now, too, though, there is a complaint hanging in the air these days about the festival that it's perhaps too expensive, inaccessible in that regard to the regular community here, something that's become just sort of for rich outsiders. Again, kind of, you know, making that Art Basel connection, you know. Right. Does the Miami economy benefit enough from this? Is this a fair criticism?
I think it is. I think at the same time, it's one that was eventually bound to happen because the price inflation we're seeing affecting American, you know, citizens, consumers, affects the festival in different ways as well, from flying the people in, the hotel rooms, the food transportation, security at the festival. Lee Traeger himself said he doesn't want to raise prices. He has had to, which does make that inaccessible inherently for residents. Some ticket prices, you know, $300.
And this is hardly $100. The only Miami event that where this accusation has been directed these days.
Yeah. No, I can think of, remember the F1 races that happened. Many people, aside from this noise, just how can I afford to go there?
Yeah.
And now in terms of economic impact and benefit, the city of Miami Beach, if I remember from a survey study, they said they expect for this year like $34 million in economic impact from the festival. And from years past, they've done, you know, about $20 million from direct expenditures, $10 million from indirect expenditures, right? People purchasing either from the festival or just in Miami Beach. So yes, those are hefty numbers of what's coming in, but what do residents, other people see from that, right? That's always the constant conversation.
Sherry, you've heard this complaint too?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard it just, you know, around friends and family where there's the excitement behind the event and then they see the ticket prices and they're like, maybe not this year.
But Sherry, Lee Schrager would argue and could argue the festival does give back to the local, not just economy, but community, especially FIU's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism, where all those festival student workers come from. You report the festival has raised more than $45 million for the school?
Yes. So I spoke to the dean of the hospitality school, Michael Chang, who told me a lot of what the school has now would not have been possible without the proceeds from the festival. That includes their very nice teaching kitchen, which I got to tour. And it's really remarkable. And they also have a completely remodeled learning space for their students who are learning beverage management. It was remodeled in 2020. They also have a restaurant at the school. It's called the Wine Spectator Lab Restaurant, and it's run by the students and professors, and it's open weekly.
Which campus is that on?
So this is on the Biscayne Bay campus. Not, that's where the hospitality school is.
Not the Miami, or not the Modesto campus, the other one. Okay. And so that's a full fledged restaurant then that the students run.
Yeah, and then there's, in addition to that, there's the scholarships that they've been able to award for students, over $2 million dollars in scholarships. Wow. And they also have an emergency fund for students too.
Sherilyn Cabrera is WLRN senior producer. Natu Tway is our morning edition host. Many thanks to you both.
Hey, thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, Miami's most beloved wildlife advocate is retiring after 46 years with Zoo Miami. Ron McGill, the zoo's communications director, is closing that chapter of a career that transformed the way South Florida experiences the natural world. McGill brought the importance of wildlife conservation to our local living rooms and classrooms, and he even brought the wildlife itself, like the four-week-old tiger cub he presented on the Spanish-language variety show Sábado Gigante with Don Francisco.
Estoy nuevamente con Ron McGill, que ha traído un tigre de cuatro semanas. Un aplauso para él. ¿Hasta qué edad se puede tener un tigre en la mano?
Bueno, normalmente 4 o 5 meses ya. Muy fuerte, puede ser muy peligroso, pero nunca deben tener un tigre como mascota.
Now, in pretty good Spanish there, McGill said you should not have a tiger as a pet. He also created the Ron McGill Conservation Endowment, which has raised millions of dollars to help wildlife populations. May 10th will be McGill's last day at Zoo Miami, but he says he will remain involved with Zoo Miami Foundation. We hope to have Ron share his thoughts and memories on the South Florida Roundup soon. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLR.